Chapter 2 of the unit is a tour of the cell, meaning we are going to survey the major parts that you find in cells. Most of those parts are examples of organelles, which are so named because they're like little organs within the cell. Before we get into that survey, though, this opening slide just shows you a range of sizes of things you find in biology. And this range is not, this is not a linear scale. This is like the pH scale. So each step is 10 times bigger than the one before it. So it's an enormous range from 0.1 nanometers down at the size of atoms all the way up to 10 meters tall, which is not even all of life, right? Sequoia trees are even taller than that. But anyway, this is enormous range includes organisms, and all organisms by definition are made of cells, but there's not a huge range in the size of cells. There are some comparatively big cells and comparatively small cells, but most of them are about the same size, roughly, in this yellow range, which is, for most cells, just a bit smaller than we can see with the naked eye, which is why we need light microscopy to view them. And as you'll see, if you've never looked at one, we'll do it in the lab. When you look at a cell with a light microscope, you can see the cell, and you can see the nucleus, if there is one. You don't see a hell of a lot more detail than that, though. If you want to see the actual organelles we're talking about, you have to use something with higher resolution, which is an electron microscope. All right, now, slide 2 shows you a cartoon cell and a real photomicrograph corresponding to it. But let's remember the dichotomy of cell types. What am I talking about? What is that dichotomy of cell types? Right. Any given cell is either a prokaryotic cell or a eukaryotic cell. And therefore, any given organism is either a prokaryote, one made of prokaryotic cells, or a eukaryote. So there's as far as cell types, there are two. And we're looking at a prokaryotic cell here. Remember that linguistically that name comes from the fact that these cells existed before any nucleus existed. They were the original cells. And so the ancestor that I keep talking about that is common to all organisms was a prokaryotic cell. That's way before the nucleus arrived on the scene evolutionarily, much later. That's the linguistic meaning of prokaryote, but that's not the only difference between a prokaryotic cell and a eukaryotic cell. Prokaryotic cells not only don't contain a nucleus, which is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle, but prokaryotic cells also don't contain any other membrane-bounded organelles. Only eukaryotic cells, which we're not looking at here, contain membrane-bounded organelles. And now, do you remember what I said the distinction is between the two similar-sounding but different phrases, membrane-bounded and membrane-bound? Because even textbooks get this wrong. I see textbooks now and then use the phrase membrane-bound organelles. That's not right. It should be membrane-bounded, because membrane-bound means tied or bound to a membrane. It's part of a membrane. Membrane-bounded means having a boundary formed by a membrane. In other words, membrane enclosed. So that's what I mean by membrane-bounded organelles. The nucleus is an example of that. The nucleus has its own membrane that surrounds it. Well, a prokaryotic cell not only does not have that, but it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles, which means there's only one membrane. Every cell, by definition, has a membrane called the plasma membrane. That's what really defines the cell. It's the boundary between the cell and everything else. But a prokaryotic cell has that membrane, and that's it. And therefore, a prokaryotic cell is not compartmentalized. there is one compartment within a prokaryotic cell. Everything making up that interior collectively is called the cytoplasm. The stuff of the cell is what it literally means. And even though prokaryotic cells do not have nuclei, they of course still have DNA for the same reasons that eukaryotic cells need DNA. It's just not, that DNA is just not enclosed within its own membrane, membrane-bounded organelle. So in a prokaryotic cell, as you see here, the DNA, shown here in purple, is just part of the cytoplasm. Still, though, it's not spread out everywhere in the cytoplasm. It's kind of kept together in one area within the cytoplasm, and that place where you find the DNA within a prokaryotic cell is called the nucleoid, which means like a nucleus. It's not a true nucleus because there is no membrane defining. But that's the part of the cytoplasm where you find a prokaryotic cell's nucleus. DNA, sorry. You also see in the cytoplasm these little brown things, which are organelles. Those are called ribosomes, and we'll talk more about them in a bit today, and we'll talk a lot more about them later. Ribosomes are organelles, but they are not membrane-bounded organelles. They're little molecular machines. They are not surrounded by their own membranes. So the fact that prokaryotic cells have them doesn't violate what I told you earlier. Prokaryotic cells do not have membrane-bounded organelles. Not all prokaryotic cells are elongated like this, by the way. There's a variety of shapes, but this is just a typical bacterium, which is, all bacteria are prokaryotic cells. I also want you to remember that there's a dichotomy of cell types, so two possibilities. But remember, as far as classification of organisms is concerned, there are three domains, right? Eukarya, which all eukaryotes belong to, including us. But the prokaryotes of the world are in either domain bacteria or in domain archaea. Those two together are the prokaryotic organisms. Bacteria is just one example. But anyway, typically, in addition to the plasma membrane that any cell has, a bacterium or a prokaryotic cell in general will have external to that plasma membrane a much thicker and more sturdy cell wall, just like plant cells do that we talked about in lab. You can see the cell wall here in one of these versions of yellow that they're using. And that, just like for a plant, that can hold in pressure. It can keep the cell from exploding osmotically. And not necessarily, but it depends on species. Sometimes external to the cell wall, you have what's called a capsule, which is a sticky layer that allows that cell to stick to some surface, like, for instance, your tonsil, which is also what these fimbriae, if they are present, which depends on species, can do. These fimbriae are hair-like cell projections. Not all prokaryotic cells feature these flagella either. Flagella is the plural of flagellum, which would be one of these whip-like appendages. If the cell is flagellated, then the flagella, however many there are used for locomotion. Flagella are locomotory devices, meaning they are there for the purpose of propelling the cell through the medium, the fluid, in which it lives. All right, that's a quick rundown of prokaryotic cells. Effectively, all the rest of the chapter deals with eukaryotic cells. But slide 3 isn't really about either type. It's about all cells. We've talked about this before. A cell isn't a cell unless it has a plasma membrane. And so plasma membranes, molecularly speaking, are made of a collection of different molecules, but the chief molecule, the one that's there in greatest abundance, is phospholipids. And this is what we've talked about before. Phospholipids are amphipathic molecules, right? each phospholipid has a polar part and a nonpolar part, or in other words, a hydrophilic part, the polar head, and a hydrophobic part, the nonpolar tails. And this is the reason cells came into existence. As these phospholipids accumulated in early Earth's history in the water where life started, because of, you know, they come into existence even without any life, right? They're just organic compounds accumulating, just like that experiment showed. When there's enough of them, they get together in the water, just like you can do today by putting pure phospholipids into water, and automatically assemble into a phospholipid bilayer, forming a little spherical bag, separating two aqueous fluids or solutions inside the bag and outside the bag. That's how the first cells came into existence. So you can do that. You won't have a cell. It's not alive. It's just a little bag of phospholipids. But that's how the cells got their start. For a living cell has to have more than just a pure phospholipid bilayer, because in order for a cell to remain alive, there needs to be things that wouldn't ordinarily be able to get into or out of that bag to get into or out of the cell. So in addition to a phospholipid bilayer, you have a whole array of different kinds of proteins, which are what these purple things are, and other things that we'll talk about in a different chapter. Now to four. In the opening slide, I said that there's not a huge range of sizes for cells, at least not when you consider all three dimensions, height, width, and depth. There are some cells that are extraordinarily large in one dimension. For instance, you know, a neuron goes all the way from a toe to the spinal cord. That's one cell. It's enormously long, right? But even though that's very long, the other two dimensions, the width and the depth, are microscopic still. A cell can't get arbitrarily big in all three dimensions. It can't grow wide, tall, and deep unlimitedly for reasons that this slide seeks to explain. There is a limit, in other words, a constraint put on how big a cell can grow in all three dimensions at one time. And that constraint or limit is called the surface to volume ratio. Like any ratio, the surface area to volume ratio is a fraction, right? In math, ratios are fractions, numerator divided by denominator. So the surface area to volume ratio is the surface area value divided by the volume value. Cells have different shapes. Some of them are kind of like cubes, plant cells especially, but most of them are kind of more spherical. Anyway, it applies no matter what the shape is, the concept here, but it's easier to think about the math using cubes to represent cells. So you have here one cell, and there aren't any units given here because the units don't really matter, but it's one unit by one unit by one unit. Okay? So it's one unit big on each side, height, width, and depth. So how do you calculate the surface area of a cube? Well, it's the combined surface area of all six of its faces, right? Each face is a square, so each face has an area that is 1 by 1, height, width times height. So 1 times 1 is 1, square area, square units. But there are six of those, so it's overall 6 square units of surface area. Do you see that? Understand what I'm saying? A cube is really just 6 squares, like the 6 sides of a die that you roll. But each one of them, as any square, to calculate the surface area of that square, it's length times height. So 1 times 1. But there are 6 of them, so it's 6 times 1 for the entire surface area. That's where this 6 comes from. All right? The volume of this, which would be cubic units, is length times width times height, 1 times 1 times 1. So the volume is 1 cubic unit, whatever units you're using, like cubic nanometers or whatever. All right? Therefore, the surface area to volume ratio, which is 1 divided by the other, is 6 divided by 1, which is 6. All right? Okay, now let's grow this cell in all three dimensions. Let's make it wider, deeper, and taller at the same time. And specifically, let's make it 5 times as big in each dimension. That's this bigger cube. And let's look at what happens to the ratio. Well, first, let's look at the area and the volume separately. When you make it 5 times as big like this, each face is 5 by 5 now. So 25 square units, right? But there are 6 of them. So 25 times 6 is where the 150 comes from. 150 square units of surface area. The volume is now 5 by 5 by 5, which is 125 cubic units. Or units cubed, same thing. And so now this new surface area to volume ratio for the bigger cell is 150 divided by 125, which is only 1.2. In other words, when a cell gets big in all three dimensions, both the surface area and the volume go up, but the surface area to volume ratio goes down, because even though surface area and volume are both going up, they're not going up at the same speed. Volume gets big faster than surface area gets big. You can see that if you graph y equals x squared for the positive numbers and compare it to y equals x cubed. Y equals x cubed gets big much quicker. So it outgrows surface area, which is only a square function. Okay. Now, the reason this has it puts a constraint on the size of cells is that to remain alive, a cell has to continuously exchange both energy and materials with the surroundings. Certain things need to go out, certain things need to come in, or the cell can't live. Well, where does that exchange of materials take place on any given cell? If you're going to get something into or out of the cube, where does that happen?
At the surface,
exactly. The surface is the boundary between everything else and the interior. So if there's going to be exchange of materials with the surroundings, it has to happen at the surface. And the bigger the volume gets, the more materials have to go out and come in to service that bigger volume. So there comes a point when the volume gets too big for the surface area. There's not enough surface for there to be enough exchange to service that bigger volume. And therefore, cells can't get big in all three dimensions indefinitely. That doesn't mean organisms can't get big, though. You all started as one cell, a zygote, but you are not now an adult-sized single zygote cell. Right? Because that would have been impossible. Instead, organisms that are big, like we are, and there's plenty of things even bigger than us, are big not because we grow one cell big, but because we become multicellular. That's represented here by this organism made of multiple cubes. It has the same overall body size as this 5x5x5 cube, but it doesn't suffer from too low a surface area to volume ratio because it's made of many individually small cells, each with its own still high surface area to volume ratio. And if you think about this in comparison to cooking, you know, if you want hash browns, for instance, you don't put a whole uncut potato into the skillet. I mean, you can do that. It'll get brown, but there's not going to be very much brown, right? Because there's not very much surface area compared to how much potato you have there. Instead, you cut it into a bunch of small pieces, each of which has its own surface, and that's what gets brown. And there's a lot more surface area to volume ratio, and therefore a lot more brown to white on the potato, on the hash browns. Okay, now we can go to 5, And this figure takes a while to get through, but the rest of them can speed up. So don't be daunted by the fact that I'm stuck here for a while, because I want to go through each of these and describe them while we're looking at all these structures at once. This is a catch-all slide, meaning that it's not necessarily true that any given cell has all of these features. This cell, this cartoon cell, is drawn just to show all the possible structures that will there. But most animal cells, this is an animal cell, will have almost all of these structures. Some of them will have some structures and not others. But first of all, animals, recall, are eukaryotic, right? We animals are members of the domain eukaryon. So it shouldn't be surprising to you that there is a nucleus here. All animals are eukaryotes. Eukaryotic cells have nuclei. And the nucleus is just one example of a membrane-bounded organelle. This is a true nucleus, which is what eukaryote means, having a true nucleus. Not only is the nucleus a membrane-bounded organelle, though, but it actually is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, meaning that the nucleus has two membranes surrounding it, two layers. And by two layers here, I'm not talking about the two monolayers of phospholipids that form a bilayer. There's already two layers of phospholipids in one membrane. Here I'm talking about two separate phospholipid bilayers, two layers of membrane, which you might not be able to see from where you're sitting, but if you look at this closer from your computer, you can see the two layers of membrane there. I'm going to give you three examples of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. The nucleus is the first. The one important thing about membrane-bounded organelles is if they are there, which they are only in eukaryotic cells, that means that the cell, which is already one compartment separate from the surroundings, is compartmentalized or subcompartmentalized. That one compartment is cut into subcompartments. And therefore, cytoplasm for a eukaryotic cell is not everything that's inside the cell like it is for a prokaryotic cell, which has only one compartment. A eukaryotic cell has cytoplasm, but cytoplasm for a eukaryotic cell is all of the stuff that's inside the cell, but also outside of all the organelle, the membrane-bounded organelles that are in that cell. So all of this purple stuff inside the nucleus is not cytoplasm. It's a separate compartment because of this membrane from the cytoplasm outside of it, but still inside the cell. The stuff inside the nucleus is called nucleoplasm. I should say, before I forget, by the way, that the two membranes that make up, that surround and define the nucleus are collectively called the nuclear envelope. So the nuclear envelope consists of two membranes. The nucleoplasm contains DNA, which probably doesn't surprise you. We've probably even said that explicitly before. DNA for a eukaryotic cell is found in the nucleus. And by the way, that's why DNA, which is a nucleic acid, was called a nucleic acid, because it's found in the nucleus. It's called a nucleic acid even for a prokaryotic cell, even though the prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus. It was discovered in the nucleus, though. And so that's an important component of the nucleoplasm, DNA. But it's more than DNA that you find in there. In fact, the DNA is not really just DNA by itself. It's DNA complexed with a bunch of proteins. And that mixture of DNA and proteins is called chromatin. That's why that label appears here. Also, notice this dark spot, which doesn't have its own membrane. It's just part of the nucleoplasm. Is called the nucleolus. Be careful with that word because you can misread it as nucleus. Nucleolus is part of the nucleus. And the nucleolus specifically is involved in making RNA molecules other than mRNA. I've spoke just a little bit so far about mRNA, but that's just one of several different kinds of RNA. mRNA is made in other parts of the nucleus using other parts of the DNA, but the nucleolus is responsible for making non-mRNA mRNA. I mean, non-mRNA RNA versions. There's other versions. All right, now, the outer... Oh, by the way, the two membranes are pretty simply described. I mean, named. They are called the outer membrane and the inner membrane. The outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, here and there, and specifically on this picture, right where I'm pointing here, folds outward every once in a while. You can see an example right here. And these colors, of course, are artificial. The colors are added just so you can see where one organelle starts and the other one ends. But right here, where it makes this turn, the outer membrane turns from purple to blue because that's officially the beginning of another organelle, even though it's the same membrane. So there are some outfoldings. And we'll talk about that blue organelle next, but before we leave the nucleus, notice also that there are a bunch of these pink holes or pores called nuclear pores in the nuclear envelope. They are little holes through the nucleus, but each hole is a complex of proteins arranged kind of like the staves of a barrel with a hollow interior so something can go through it. Major thing that needs to go through it, by the way, is mRNA. mRNA is produced where the DNA is, and the DNA is in there, but the mRNA, once it's produced, which is carrying the code for how to build a protein, needs to go out into the cytoplasm to do its job of hitching up with a ribosome and producing a polypeptide. So it has to get out, the mRNA has to get out of the nucleus. It's a pretty big molecule, so it requires these holes called nuclear pores. Now, this blue organelle, which is continuous with the membrane of the nucleus, but considered a distinct organelle, is a two-part organelle, meaning it's all connected, but there are two different shapes to it and correspondingly two different major functions to it. But overall, all of this blue is collectively called the endoplasmic reticulum. The subdivisions, though, of that, the two parts, are, as you see, the rough endoplasmic reticulum, rough ER, and the smooth ER. Look how much different they just look compared to each other. The smooth ER has more of a web-like shape. It's like tubes that are connected like a web. Whereas the rough ER is more like flattened sacs. And this is a cutaway view. You're seeing it cut right here. So you can see the insides of these flattened sacs. But the sacs are made up, the sacs and the tubes are all made out of the same membrane material, just in different shapes. Now, the reason smooth and rough were used to name these is that the roughness for the rough ER, when you look at it under a microscope, comes from the fact that there are all of these brown little dots here. Well, just like they were brown dots in the cartoon for the prokaryotic slide earlier, these brown dots are ribosomes. Now, the blue is the endoplasmic reticulum. That's an organelle. But each individual brown dot is also an organelle, much smaller, a ribosome. And remember, the ribosomes are not membrane-bounded organelles. They are associated, though, at the moment, these brown dots, ribosomes, with the endoplasmic reticulum, the part that has the flattened sacs. And that's why we call this part of the ER the rough ER. They're not associated with the smooth ER, and that makes sense when you consider the difference in functions between these two parts. The major job of the smooth ER, or I'll give you a couple jobs that it performs, is lipid synthesis. This is where lipids are produced in cells. And another major function of the smooth ER is to store certain particles, including calcium ions, for instance. Calcium ions can serve as a major signal in cells. This is exactly how your muscle cells get the signal to actually contract. But only if the calcium ions are in the cytoplasm. Well, they're not in the cytoplasm if they are sequestered or hidden in the interior, the hollow interior, which is described by a general word called lumen. The lumen is the hollow interior of something. If they're in the lumen of the smooth ER, then they are not in the cytoplasm. And in response to electrical stimulation from a neuron in a muscle cell, those calcium ions can then spill out of the ER and into the cytoplasm, and that's part of causing your muscle contraction. So that's the rough ER. The smooth ER, sorry. The rough ER has a totally different major job, which involves the ribosomes, which is why it makes sense that these ribosomes are on the surface of the rough ER. The major function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is the modification of newly made polypeptides. We haven't really looked closely at the process of producing a polypeptide in a cell, but we've looked at how polypeptides are built molecularly, right? They are polymers of amino acids. And the polymer is built one amino acid at a time. They're linked together to build a longer and longer chain. Well, when the polypeptide is built, it's just a linear arrangement of amino acids. But in order for it to function, remember, it has to have the correct shape that it folds into. And sometimes, after you have just built a polypeptide, depends on the polypeptide, some of them need to be modified after they're built. For instance, add something other than an amino acid to it, or maybe even chop some of the amino acids off so it will have its right shape. Those modifications, whatever they are performed in the lumen or hollow interior of the rough ER. But the ribosomes are the organelles that are responsible for building the polypeptides. And so that's why these ribosomes are associated with the rough ER, because the polypeptides that they are building, the strings that are coming up from them, are polypeptides that need to be modified, and they're strung right into the lumen so that they can be modified. The rough ER not only performs that modification, whatever it is, depends on the protein, but then the rough ER packages that newly modified protein, or a collection of them, into little bags made out of membrane. And a bag of membrane material is called a vesicle. We can see a vesicle here in teal, but there's ones that would be colored blue as well, coming off of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. There just isn't one in this figure. All right. But this brings up the important point that membrane material is the same whichever membrane-bounded organelle you're talking about that it's part of. And it, not only is it the same chemically, but it moves around. Membrane material moves around, and the major way in which it moves around is by forming these little vesicles that pinch off of one organelle and then get sent to another organelle and become part of it. Okay, that's the endoplasmic reticulum. If it weren't for the colors, this were all just non-color, like it would be under a microscope looking at a living cell, you probably would overlook this teal-colored one because you would think, well, this is just more of the rough ER. But notice that it's not rough in the sense that it does not have these ribosomes. That's one difference. But also, thankfully, they've colorized it for us so we can tell the difference. It's right next to the rough ER, and it's also a system of flattened sacs made out of membrane material, but this is its own organelle, which is named after a dead Italian. So it's called either the Golgi apparatus, depending on which textbook you read. It will be called either the Golgi apparatus or the Golgi complex. or sometimes just the Golgi. They all refer to the same thing. The Golgi apparatus is not only its own organelle, it has its own major function. And more or less it serves as a receiving and shipping center. Just like a factory will have a receiving and a shipping center, and they're separate from each other, right? The receiving center has its own parking lot where the trucks that are bringing things to the factory come in, and separate lot for the outgoing trucks that are taking things from the factory to deliver elsewhere. Similarly, there's an incoming side to the Golgi apparatus and an outgoing side. This side that is right up next to the rough ER is the income, the receiving part of the Golgi complex. So when I say it's like a ship, a receiving and shipping center, the Golgi complex receives packages, vesicles, containing newly modified proteins that come from the rough ER, because the rough ER just finished doing that modification, receives those modified proteins in vesicle form, and then figures out where these now modified proteins need to go. Some of them need to be embedded in the plasma membrane, for instance, become membrane-bound proteins for the plasma membrane. Some of them need to be fully exported out of the cell into the extracellular fluid. And so the Golgi figures that out on a per protein basis. And once it figures it out, it packages them together. The ones that are going the same place are packaged together in a vesicle. A new vesicle that comes from the membrane made out of Golgi membrane. And that's exactly what this teal colored one is. This membrane material used to be part of the organelle. And some of that material used to be part of the blue Golgi. I mean the blue endoplasmic reticulum. There's movement of membrane material all the time. And so that's how the proteins get to where they need to go, from the receiving center of the Golgi complex. Working clockwise, we next have lysosome labeled here. And some or soma means body. What about lice? What does that mean? Lysis is what? Splitting. Yeah, so linguistically this means a splitting body. It's called that because what happens inside a lysosome, which is its own organelle, is hydrolysis reactions. Lysis is occurring. In other words, big molecules get split into smaller molecules in a lysosome. And those hydrolysis reactions are, like biochemical reactions in general, catalyzed by their own enzymes, which collectively are called hydrolytic enzymes. Well, hydrolytic enzymes, since they are responsible for breaking things into smaller chunks, are dangerous things to have in the cell, in the main compartment of the cell, because they can start breaking things apart that you don't want to be broken apart. Right? The integrity of the cell would be in jeopardy if you had these hydrolytic enzymes just in the main compartment. So these hydrolytic enzymes are kept safely away from the cytoplasm by enclosing them in their own little piece of membrane, making up the lysosome. Next is the mitochondrion, which is a singular word. This is pointing to just one. But the plural of mitochondrion is mitochondria. And a mitochondrion is the second example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. Not only is it membrane-bounded, it is multiply membrane-bounded. There are two membranes here in orange. Each of these bean-shaped things is a mitochondrion. And we'll look at the detail when we get a closer picture. But a mitochondrion has, as its major function, a complex set of reactions that we'll study in Unit 3 called cellular respiration, which is an important way in which eukaryotic cells can maximize the amount of energy that can be extracted from food particles, from whatever, from whatever fuel molecules the cell is burning for fuel, for energy, I mean. Okay, next up is peroxisome. And if it weren't for the colorization, you would say, what's the difference between this and a lysosome? They look identical. They pretty much are identical. They're little bags of membrane. But what happens inside them is slightly different. So they have different names, different functions. The major function of peroxisomes is to deal with the problem that in the course of ordinary metabolism, just the cell doing its ordinary living, there are byproducts that are formed that are called reactive oxygen species, which is usually just abbreviated as ROS. Reactive oxygen species, there's multiple different versions, but peroxides are examples of reactive oxygen species. As the name implies, these things are highly reactive, mainly because of the oxygen in them. Remember, oxygen is greedy when it comes to electrons. So reactive oxygen species are not only reactive, specifically they are likely to react in such a way that they cause oxidation, which, remember, is taking away electrons from something else, right? Well, that can damage the thing that's becoming oxidized. And so these are dangerous things to have around the cell as well, but they build up naturally over the course of metabolism. And therefore, peroxisomes have evolved as a way to safely deal with these things, turn them into something safe, but within a membrane-bounded vesicle, safely away from the rest of the cytoplasm. The problem with these things building up is why you see in nutrition or on commercials, or you just hear about it all the time, the importance of antioxidants. Antioxidants are supplements that you can take that do a similar job to these peroxisomes, but just even more of it. Because oxidation of your cells is part of aging, for instance. It damages things. Next are the microvilli that are labeled here. This is a good example of something that not all animal cells are going to have, but some do. And if a cell has any microvilli, it could have them on just one edge, like it does here, instead of all over. But the word is plural here. Microvillus, U-S ending, is a singular. A villus is its own word. A villus is a finger-like projection of something. So there are all kinds of villi in the body, for instance, in the human body. Your tongue has a bunch of villi. Each little bump on your tongue is a villus. Microvilli, therefore, just means very small finger-like projections because it's subcellular, smaller than the cell itself. Why would a cell, though, if it does have microvilli, have these little finger-like projections? What does that accomplish? Anyone guess?
Is it also?
Also what?
The
prokaryote
at the pyramid.
Oh, it's not for locomotion. No, but that's a good guess because it's a projection. No, what microvilli do for the cell, if they are there, is to increase the surface area in that region. Because it's an increase in membrane, right? Without actually affecting the volume much, because in between is actually outside of the cell. That's not part of the cell's volume. But it's a way of causing a lot more membrane to be used in this area, and more membrane means more area. This is a cutaway view of the cell, notice. So this edge that you see is just a cut part of the overall plasma membrane. But I like that it's a cutaway view because you can kind of think about this edge of the membrane here as being the beach around an island. And if you were to have to walk from here to here, from point A to point B on the smooth part, where there are no microvilli, it's a pretty straight shot, right? You would just walk from here to here. But if you were to go that overall total distance as the crow flies from here to here, but have to walk along this beach, you would walk a hell of a lot farther, right, to get the overall same distance, because there's a lot more membrane there. So it's an increase in surface area that these microvilli accomplish. And a perfect example of that in your body would be the cells that make up the endothelium, or inner lining, of your small intestine. The small intestine is an organ whose major job is to absorb molecules that were in your food originally, but the food particles are way too big to get into your body. We don't put food into our body, even though we say it all the time. We put food into the alimentary canal, which is a continuous tube from mouth to anus, but the interior of that tube is outside of your body. Your body is wrapped around that tube. And the food particles, when you eat food, are way too big to get into cells. That's why the first job, before you can absorb, the first job of the digestive system is to digest it while it's still outside your body into molecules. The proteins that you eat get digested into amino acids, small enough. The fats get digested into fatty acids and glycerol. Subunits that we've been talking about already, right? That's still outside your body. But once they're small enough, then they can be absorbed and actually officially enter your body by going into the cells of your body. Well, the first cells that receive them are the ones lining the gut. And for that to happen, these particles from food need to pass through the plasma membrane. Well, they can't do that directly. They need the help of proteins that are part of the membrane, like those purple globs that were in an earlier slide. And therefore, the more membrane you have, the more of these proteins, these transport proteins, you can fit in there. It's like putting in more turnstiles at a stadium, and you can handle a lot more crowd getting through at once, right? Because that stuff is only going to be available to absorb for a limited amount of time. It's passing through you. It'll be wasted if the small intestine doesn't grab it while it's there. And that's why those cells have microvilli. It's a lot more surface area. Next up is one in all caps word called the cytoskeleton, which linguistically means cell skeleton. Cyte or cyto means cell. But as you can see here, the cytoskeleton as an overall structure is made up of three major kinds of proteins: microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. And we will we'll look at these three major kinds of proteins in a different slide when we can see them better, but those are that's a listing of them for now. So above that you have the centrosome, and this is a little bit confusing because it looks like the centrosome label here is pointed to this T-shaped thing. The T-shaped thing is not the centrosome. The T-shaped thing, which looks like two pieces, short pieces of licorice, those two pieces are in a T-shaped arrangement. But those things are called centrioles. And they are in the centrosome, but they are not the centrosome itself. Okay? The centrosome is this kind of yellowish halo in this figure. This whole region is the centrosome. Now, I wish that I could tell you what centrioles are for, but we really haven't figured it out yet. Animal cells, which is what we're looking at here, have centrioles in their centrosomes, but we don't really know what they do. Now, the centrosome itself which eukaryotic cells have in general, not just animals. Plants, for instance, also have centrosomes. Centrosomes are microtubule organizing centers, which is why you see these microtubules in yellow coming out from the centrosome. It's where microtubules grow from. And so a major function that we'll look at the details of later that the centrosome is involved in, or two centrosomes at that point, is division of the nucleus, which is a process that we call mitosis. We'll look at mitosis in its own chapter later, but the centrosome is really important in that process. Well, it kind of stands to reason that since the centrioles are part of the centrosome in an animal cell, that they must somehow be involved in mitosis, which involves the centrosome. But we've actually experimentally removed the centrioles from animal cells, and they still can undergo mitosis just fine. So we just haven't figured it out. Plus, you don't have centrioles in the centrosomes that plants have, and they undergo mitosis pretty much the same way animal cells do. So it's just one of many examples of things we don't know. All right, flagellum is here. This is another good example of something that is part of this catch-all slide, but not every animal cell is going to be flagellated. What is a good example, though, of a human cell that does have a flagellum? A sperm cell, exactly. And like I said, when we mentioned flagella for the bacterium, a prokaryotic cell, if a cell does have some number of flagella, they are there for the purpose of locomotion, just like in a sperm. A sperm has to go, from its point of view, in terms of body lengths for the cell itself, it has to go an enormously long distance that has to swim to get to an egg. And it does that by its flagellum, which propels it through the medium. And so that is an animal cell. The rest of these slides won't take quite as long. But slide 6 is a very similar-looking slide, except that here this is not an animal cell, this is a plant cell. Well, plant cells are also eukaryotic, and so they have a lot of the same organelles that animal cells do, and I'm not going to go through those again. I'm only going to focus on this slide on the things that plant cells have that we don't find in animal cells. One of those things we've already talked about a little bit, which is a cell wall, this dark brown, thick covering that's external to the plasma membrane. Every cell has a plasma membrane, including plant cells, but plants, in addition to that, have this sturdy cell wall. We talked already about this in the lab, that holds in the pressure, which is why they prefer a hypotonic environment, right? The incoming water pressurizes the cell, but it doesn't burst like an animal cell would because the cell wall holds that pressure in. So that's one major difference. Another is this organelle that looks empty in the middle here, this huge one. It's not actually empty, but the fact that it looks empty is how it got its name. This is called the central vacuole. Well, vacuous means empty. It's not really empty. It's mostly water, and it can contain other things as well. For instance, in lab, when we look through the scopes, we'll be looking at onion cells, red onion cells. And macroscopically, you can tell when you look at a red onion that part of it's white, part of it's red, right? Part of pink, whatever, magenta. Well, when you look at an individual cell, from that red layer of the onion, not the entire cell is that redness. The pigment molecules that make it look pink to us are in the central vacuole. But another thing that the central vacuole can be used for is more or less as a trash dump. If a plant cell wants to get rid of something from the cytoplasm, keep it out of the main cytoplasm, then it can dump it into the central vacuole. But it's mostly water. And the fact that it's mostly water is one reason why plants can grow so much more quickly than animals, with some exceptions, of course. But I mean, I'm sure you've seen seedlings that just overnight pop up or get quite a bit bigger. Well, they do that just like animals when they grow, not by having a cell get big, but by having a bunch of cells be added. Each new cell requires some things that need to be built, whether it's an animal or a plant. But for a plant, look how much of the volume is occupied by the central vacuole, which is just water, and water doesn't have to be built. It just has to be absorbed from the surroundings. It's already water. So it can happen kind of quickly compared to an animal. These green things, there's three here. Typically, in a cell that would have them, there would be about 50. But these are called chloroplasts. And chloroplasts are the third example of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. So we had the nucleus, we had the mitochondrion, now we have the chloroplast. And the chloroplast will also look at much greater detail later on in unit 3. But for now, let me just tell you that the major function of chloroplasts is a complex set of reactions called photosynthesis. This is why we don't find these in animal cells, because photosynthesis has the goal, if you think of it in terms of goals, of producing food. Produces organic materials, which can be used as food, out of inorganic materials. And only a special type of organism is capable of doing that. Do you remember what I said is the dichotomy with respect to the ability to do this? In ecology, there's two types of organisms. Did I say this? What do we call the organisms that are able to do this, to make their own food?
Producers.
Now, they're not making food for anyone but themselves, but the rest of the world ecologically is the organisms collectively called the consumers. No consumer, including all animals, can make their own food. They have to eat something else to get food. And they can eat producers, they can eat consumers that eat producers, they can eat consumers that eat consumers that eat producers, but it always goes back to producers. Plants are major producers, but they're not the only producers. Photosynthesis, which is what goes on in a chloroplast, is not performed only by plants either. There are other eukaryotes, algae for instance, that are photosynthetic. And photosynthesis was not invented by plants. Photosynthesis existed long before any plants existed. Like almost all important biochemical pathways or sets of reactions, photosynthesis was invented by prokaryotes. Prokaryotes did everything first when there was nothing but prokaryotes. There are bacteria that are photosynthetic, even though no bacterium has a chloroplast, right? Because bacteria are prokaryotes. They don't have membrane-bounded organelles, so they therefore don't have chloroplasts. Well, they perform the same set of functions with their only membrane they have in those cells that do it. But in eukaryotic cells, that set of reactions that we call photosynthesis happens in its own membrane-bounded organelle called the chloroplast. One thing that I haven't mentioned on this slide is that when you look at the cell wall, which is between two cells, this cell is defined by its own plasma membrane here. The next cell would be right here. But in the cell wall that separates them, through the cell wall, here and there, are these little tunnel-like structures. And these tunnels get their own name, which is plasmodesmata. That is a plural. Notice it's pointing to two. The singular of plasmodesmata is just plasmodesma. And they not are just look like tunnels. They are tunnels, meaning they're passageways for things that are the right size and shape to be able to pass through, meaning go from one cell in the plant to another cell. And therefore, they are means of communication between cells. They are examples, these plasmodesmata, of what we call intercellular junctions. A junction is just a place where two things join. So intercellular means between cells. We'll look at animal intercellular junctions later, but this is a plant intercellular junction. And in this cutaway view where you see the plasmodesmata cut away, notice the coloration here. This lighter yellow is plasma membrane. And so not only is the plasmodesma a passageway from one cell to the other, but it's lined, the tunnel itself is lined by plasma membrane material, right? And so this plasma membrane of this cell continues and becomes part of the plasma membrane of this next cell. What this means is that even though in a tree, which is quadrillions of cells big, each cell is connected, really. So there, we can talk about the cytoplasm in a cell, but really in the overall tree, there is a huge cytoplasm, which is all continuous because of these plasmodesmata. The rest of it I have already talked about because they are things that we animals have as well, including mitochondria. Okay. Now we can speed up a little bit as we take closer looks at each of these things that we've already talked about. Slide 7 is a good picture of not only the nucleus, which is one membrane-bonded organelle, but the nearby endoplasmic reticulum. Gives you a much better view of what I was showing you before, the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope here and there folds outward to become the rough and or the endoplasmic reticulum in general. The rough is shown here, not the smooth, but you can see in greater detail all of the ribosomes that give it its roughness. Now, these ribosomes that are shown in this picture are not part of the endoplasmic reticulum. They're just associated with it. The endoplasmic reticulum is just the blue stuff. The ribosomes are associated with it, but only at the moment. You take a picture later, it'll also show you ribosomes. But they won't be the same ribosomes that are on here right now. So that's a temporary association between ribosomes and the rough ER. They're only there for as long as it takes them to continue building that string of amino acids to deliver into the hollow rough ER so that it can modify them. Then the ribosomes detach. You also get a close-up view here of nuclear pore complexes. Each of these little pieces of the circle is a protein, and they're arranged in a way that makes it a hollow hole through which mRNA can pass to get out of the membrane. Okay, now to 8. We've just talked a little bit about ribosomes. Here we see a ribosome in detail. It's not just a brown dot. This is a cartoon version, of course, but it shows you some truth, and also it's a lie for a reason I'll get into in a second. But the truth of it is that a single ribosome, which is a, remember, it's an organelle, but not a membrane-bounded organelle. A single ribosome, though, is a two-part structure. There are two subunits that make it up, which are called the large ribosomal subunit and the small ribosomal subunit. But the lie that's being told here is that you would not actually see both subunits together without anything there as well. The two subunits come together to form the complete ribosome only if messenger RNA is already there. And so that's the lie part, but it shows you that there's a comparatively bigger subunit and a smaller subunit. And in the micrograph, you can see two listings, free ribosomes and bound ribosomes. Well, this is just a functional distinction. All ribosomes within a cell are the same as far as structure is concerned. But the reason we call some of them free and some of them bound happens to be what they are doing at the moment. All ribosomes start out, when the two subunits come together finally, as what are called free ribosomes. Free means that they are not attached to a membrane. They're just in the cytoplasm, or the liquid component of the cytoplasm, which collectively is called the cytosol, the cell solution. All right, so when two subunits come together, that's always as a free ribosome. That's how they start. Bound ribosomes are bound to a membrane. So all of those ribosomes that give the rough ER, its roughness in appearance, those are bound ribosomes. But first they were free ribosomes, and they started making a polypeptide and realized, well, this polypeptide is going to need to be modified. So I'm going to take the whole thing over to the membrane and attach to it and become a bound ribosome. But only until that process of producing the polypeptide is done. And then not only does the ribosome detach, but as we'll look at later, the two ribosomal subunits come apart. The ribosome disintegrates. Okay, 9. So another view of the membrane making off the rough ER, but the new part of this slide is that we can see a little vesicle being formed. This is what I talked about before. You're finally seeing a picture of it, though. As the modification of the proteins takes place, which is what the job of the rough ER, as that's happening in the lumen, the hollow interior, it needs to send these modified proteins to the next organelle in the set of steps, which would be the Golgi complex. And to do that, it needs to package it, put it in its own little box, made out of membrane, that's a vesicle. And the reason this vesicle is blue is to indicate that this vesicle used to be part of the rough ER, and it's just a little piece that budded off. But membrane material is membrane material, so this can easily then become part of the Golgi complex when that vesicle moves over to the nearby Golgi complex, which probably is what we see in the next slide. Yes, it is. Slide 10. I already mentioned that the Golgi complex is like a receiving and shipping center, which are two different jobs. And therefore, the Golgi is often described as being polarized. Nothing to do with charge, it just means that there's two ends that do different things. And notice the terminology here, the two ends or faces, the receiving end and the shipping end, use the same terminology as geometric isomers, cis and trans. The cis face, cis means same side. The cis face is the receiving end. So in the overall cell, the cis face of the Golgi complex is the part that's right up against the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Because that rough ER is forming vesicles from itself to send to the cis face of the Golgi so it can receive that vesicle. That's why this vesicle is blue. It was just part of the rough ER. But notice that it is coalescing or kind of melting into the membrane that makes up the Golgi complex. This is very similar to coalescing of oil droplets. If you see oil droplets floating on water, if you're cooking, you'll see them just as they're moving around, two droplets that hit each other. And because they're both lipids, they will just coalesce into a bigger droplet. Same is happening with these phospholipids that make up the membrane material. So this is now this formerly blue part of the Golgi complex, of the rough ER is now part of the Golgi complex. This teal one is a brand new vesicle coming off of the shipping end, because the Golgi has already figured out where these modified proteins need to go, and they're now boxing them into a box to be delivered. That's coming off the trans face. And 11. What we see happening on A down here, labeled as phagocytosis, but even more generally a word than that, is that this is an example of one of the three categories of transport processes that I discussed in the last laboratory meeting. Do you remember what the three categories are of transport processes that can bring things into or take things out of cells?
Active,
passive, and this one, which is vesicular transport. Vesicular is just the adjective form of vesicle, little bag of membrane. So if you have transport into or out of the cell involving a vesicle to do that transport, then it's vesicular transport. That's the general term. But because you can use vesicles to either put things into or take things out of cells, we subdivide it into two subcategories of vesicular transport. If you are moving things out of the cell, we call it exocytosis. Osis means condition, cyte means cell, exo means out. So it's condition of taking something out of the cell. The reverse process, using a vesicle to bring something into the cell, is called endocytosis. And we see one example of that right here in A. Notice a vesicle is forming for the purpose of bringing stuff, this brown material, into the cell. Well, endocytosis only tells you as a word that it's inward vesicular transport. There's two kinds of endocytosis, though. Phagocytosis is one example. And the phago part of that means eat. So phagocytosis linguistically means condition of cell eating. Just by analogy with us eating chunks, solid chunks. The same process can be used, though, to more or less take a sip of the liquid exterior, in which case it's cell drinking, which is called pinocytosis. All right, so that's the distinction. But vesicular transport, whether it's exocytosis or endocytosis, outward or inward movement, is a little bit of a cheating mechanism. Because in passive and active transport, whatever is being transported into or out of the cell is going through the membrane to get either into or out of the cell. But in vesicular transport, the reason I say it's cheating is that whatever is being transported actually doesn't ever go through a membrane, including this brown chunk right here. It's outside of the cell right now. If the plasma membrane starts invaginating or in-pocketing, it forms a partial vesicle. It's called a food vacuole here, but a vacuole is a vesicle. And if it continues that, encloses this brown thing, and then pinches off so it's a complete vesicle, now the brown thing is inside the cell, but it never went through a membrane, right? That's what vesicular transport accomplishes. And notice that what's happening here is this food vacuole is going, since it's made out of membrane, is coalescing with a lysosome, which is the stuff containing the dangerous hydrolytic enzymes, right? And that's how you get these hydrolytic enzymes exposed to the thing that you do want to break apart, but safely away from the things in the cell that you don't want to break apart. The autophagy that you see happening on the right is the same process as far as using the lysosome. It means, autophagy though means self-eating. This isn't bringing in an external particle as food. What it's doing is eating or breaking apart something that's already in the cell. That's why it's called self-eating. In this case, it happens to be a mitochondrion, which has seen better days. This mitochondrion is no longer functioning. So it's worthless as far as cellular respiration, the function, is concerned. But it's still valuable in for its parts. Just like you don't put a car that's no longer running into the dump, right? Cars are highly recycled. Every little bit of them almost is used for something. So it's made out of the various macromolecules that we've already talked about, and therefore if you just break it apart, you get these monomers, which can then be rearranged to build new stuff. It's recycled. And that brings me to exactly where I wanted to end today anyway. That puts us even with the other section. I'll see you Wednesday.